Welcome to session four. Our first speaker will be Tom Quinn, also a seasoned veteran of Water Center Reviews, who will talk to us this afternoon on It's About Time, Natural and Unnatural Selection on Migration and Spawning in Pacific Salmon, from the guy who wrote the book.
Sticking around to the latter end of the afternoon, I know I'm standing between you and the reception, so I'll try and move things along. I've been coming to these and participating since the Center for Streamside Studies got going, and I'm sort of surprised to find myself the only unabashed, dyed-in-the-wool salmon biologist talk in the whole day. So I have to hold up the honor of our good friends. What I want to talk about is a subject very near and dear to my heart, migration patterns and also evolutionary processes. We hear about geological processes, but of course those are not the only long-term sort of thing that goes on. The overall themes for folks that want to leave early and get to the wine bar, natural selection operates very powerfully on timing in salmon, more so than many other kinds of fishes, by the way. They're adapted to local conditions. They show signs of adaptation to climate change. That's one of the themes. But there are two forms of artificial selection, well, at least two, that I'm going to talk about, selection in hatcheries and selection from fisheries, and we have complicated effects that are pushing them back and forth as we have a couple of different forms of unnatural selection and complicated forms of natural selection that are going on. So the first thing is that individual salmon species, in particular rivers, have quite well-established and predictable patterns of migratory timing. This just happens to be data from the Army Corps of Engineers, the locks here for 2007, just as an example. There's zigs and zags, but the sockeye salmon come in first, followed by the Chinook salmon, followed by the coho salmon, and these are very well-established and have been known by fisheries, biologists, and fishermen for a long time. If you kind of smooth that out and look at the 50% or the median date, you see they're off by about a month in these sort of situations. And again, salmon biologists are very familiar with these highly predictable patterns. You say, well, why do they migrate when they do? And it's been said that the problem is that life has to be lived forward but can only be understood backward. And so you say, well, why do salmon migrate when they do? In order to understand that, you've got to go to the time when their offspring emerge the following spring and work your way backward from that. So the key event, really, is when do you want your children to emerge in the gravel next spring? Decide that date based on emergence of insects and temperature. Then figure out what the average temperature regime will be over the winter, because temperature will determine how quickly they incubate. That will determine when you have to spawn. Once we know when you have to spawn, when you're going to migrate will be determined by how long it will take you to get there, and if there are particular conditions of temperature or flow that you might have to avoid in order to optimize your location. So in some cases, the fish slide in out of the ocean and spawn in a day. In other cases, they migrate in many months before they spawn because particular combinations of temperature and flow necessitate getting in early to get past particularly difficult areas. Well, then we start thinking about what kind of patterns would we see on a broad scale. And these are some data that Sarah Hodgson, a former student of mine, and I pulled together for sockeye salmon. And you can use latitude as a crude surrogate for thermal regime. And what you find in the northern latitudes, the sockeye spawn quite early. And we talk about salmon as being fall spawners, but they're spawning in July, which is kind of marginally fall, if you think about it. And their offspring may be emerging 10 or 11 months later. So very, very long incubation period. As you move down to lower latitudes, warmer conditions, they spawn, generally speaking, later in the season. Well, you might say, well, yeah, okay, Tom, but there's certain... Boy, I'm having a lot of difficulties with the technology here. Well, you can see there's a bunch of variation in the middle. And when you look at those within a particular watershed, like, for example, the Fraser River system, as Ernie Brannan did, the dominant temperature regime in the particular spawning stream within a river system also controls when the fish spawn. So the colder the river, the earlier they tend to spawn because the embryos will be developing relatively slowly under those cold conditions. And so in the warm situations like Cultus, where they're spawning in a lake-fed, you know, groundwater-fed beach, they're spawning basically at Christmas time. Okay, well, so far so good. Well, it turns out, now we're starting to bring in a little bit of climate here, turns out that mortality in a river system like the Fraser, although not restricted to the Fraser River, can be affected by temperature. Species like sockeye are stressed by high temperatures, and when they're exposed to those, the mortality either en route or the mortality on the spawning grounds is elevated when temperatures are relatively high. So in some situations, like Lake Washington, the sockeye migrate before we reach our peak temperatures. In other cases, they migrate after the peak temperatures, and those individuals that get it wrong get killed. And because, of course, they have no children, natural selection is operating against the genes that control that pattern of migratory timing. Well, if it's not so good to come in when the water is warm, things have been getting a lot warmer around here. Now, if I just showed you the top graph for the Columbia River, you might say, well, you know, that's the effect of hydroelectric dams and so forth. I submit that the Fraser River, which has no main stem dam, shows the same slope, different in elevation because it's farther north, but it actually tracks remarkably closely, suggesting that there are some dominant overall climatological processes at work. So we have long-term adaptation of populations to thermal regimes in rivers and spawning streams, changing conditions, mortality associated with that, that would suggest that we are actually selecting for fish with different migratory timing. And this, in fact, is what we're starting to see. I wrote a paper with Dean Adams a while ago pointing out that the sockeye migratory timing in the Columbia River system has been getting earlier. In this case, they migrate before the peak temperatures. And the peak temperatures have been getting warmer, and it's been getting warmer earlier in the Columbia River system, and the migration has been getting progressively earlier. Recently, Lisa Crozier, research scientist at NOAA, extended the data set from my paper with Dean about another 15 years, and the trend has continued. You might say, well, on an absolute basis, that's only about 10 days, but in terms of the migratory timing of fishes, that's actually quite significant and evidence that they are evolving in response to these kind of changing climate conditions. Well, now we've seen a little bit about evolution, a little bit about climate change. I promised you something about hatcheries. Old-timers might recognize this, but this is an artist's rendering of the UW hatchery. Now, I don't know if we have any boaters in the audience? Probably a few. I think this guy is coming in hot. I think this guy is coming in way too fast, and if I was on that bulkhead, I would move. But, you know, that's why it is an artist's rendering. Anyway, the University of Washington hatchery was established to facilitate research and teaching, chiefly on Chinook salmon and rainbow trout, but also on coho salmon. The late Doc, or Lauren Donaldson, was the man who established this. And the stock of Chinook and coho was largely derived from Issaquah Creek and Green River origin. I don't want to go into the complicated genealogy here, but I took the opportunity to go back through the records and look at the possible changes in spawning date that have occurred among these populations. And you might ask, well, why might we think that there might be differences in date? The University of Washington hatchery takes its water from the outflow of Lake Washington. Essentially, the epilimni on the surface waters, and it's considerably warmer than those creeks. Issaquah Creek is a little bit warmer than Sioux Creek, and so based on this whole idea of timing and temperature, we might predict that there would be some differences there. Well, in general, the three hatcheries do follow this rule of colder is earlier. So the Sioux Creek population spawns earlier, and this is an average over a number of years, followed by Issaquah Creek, and the University of Washington is later than that. But the phenomenon is a little bit more interesting because we've actually seen very, very dramatic trends over time. And you think about this, you're the hatchery manager. You're out there, and you're waiting for the salmon to arrive. You're not sure how many are going to come. The boss wants you to fill all the egg trays and to meet the capacity. So as I say, one in the hand or two in the bush, the first salmon that come in are likely to get spawned. Until the capacity of the hatchery is reached, they may eventually cull some of those first fish, but the tendency is to spawn the early arriving fish. It's just general human nature. And so in this sense, selection, artificial selection, different from the selection that would occur on spawning grounds, favors early arrival. And sure enough, in all three hatcheries, we not only see the difference in average timing, but a very dramatic shift in the median spawning date of those populations over time. So they're spawning substantially earlier than they used to. Okay. Well, if salmon tend to spawn late where the water is warm, because it may be intolerable to adults or it accelerates the development of the embryos, hatcheries tend to spawn them early. What happens when these processes, climate change and hatchery selection, run up against each other because we've got some sort of a conflict here? Well, It's clear from surface water temperatures in Lake Washington and also records in Issaquah Creek and Sioux Creek that they're all been getting warmer. And whether this is greenhouse gases or watershed management isn't particularly important because the fish only experience the water. They don't experience the reason. In all cases, it's been getting warmer, which should have been selecting for several reasons for later spawning, but in fact it's been getting earlier, which suggests that the artificial selection is trumping climate change, at least in this particular situation, for the moment. So we've seen some general evolutionary principles, some applications to climate change, the ways in which artificial selection in a hatchery can play a role. How about a wild population? What we see in the Cedar River is that they're actually spawning later than they used to, the wild population, exactly what would have been predicted from the normal adaptation to changing climate. So it looks as though we have a conflict between how the hatchery populations are performing and how a wild population is performing. Well, now we go to fisheries. I love this picture of my graduate student, Neela Kendall, on a boatload of sockeye salmon up in Bristol Bay, where we don't have hatcheries, but we definitely have fishing. We don't have land use practices. We don't have hydroelectric dams. So the dominant human interaction with salmon is by catching them and eating them. And because the populations there vary in abundance, the proportion that gets caught goes up and down. In these areas, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game manages the salmon for what's called an escapement goal. They determine a priori the carrying capacity of the system for spawners, and they say we need 1.2 million sockeye in this system and 2.3 million in this system. It is the primary job of the fishery manager to make sure that the escapement goal is met. The surplus goes to the fishermen. So in recent years, when the runs have been relatively high, a large proportion gets caught by the fishermen. When the runs are relatively poor, they still try and meet the escapement goal, and the fishermen simply take fewer fish. So the primary goal is to meet the escapement goal, but the fishery is high, and so there's certainly substantial scope for selection here. As an example from one of these systems, these are data in green as the run of sockeye. And yes, these are daily counts in hundreds of thousands, so we're not in Idaho. They come in over a very, very short period. In about 2 weeks, you get 60, 70, 80% of the fish. So they're coming in very, very short period of time. And the psychological problem for the fishery manager is in many ways analogous to the same problem of the hatchery manager. The hatchery manager doesn't know how many salmon are going to come in, and he doesn't want to get caught short. Likewise, the fishery manager has a forecast, but he doesn't know exactly how many salmon are going to arrive. Job one is not to satisfy the fishermen, but to meet the conservation goals of the population and to get the fish on the spawning grounds. So, of course, the conservative thing is to have the harvest rate relatively low at the beginning. And that's exactly what we see. On a calculated, on a per-day basis, the harvest rate is relatively low for the first few days until the manager starts to get a feeling that the run is building. He's got some confidence that they're going to start to come in at or above expectation and gradually dials it up. And you see the latter part of the run may be exploited at 70, 80, 90% as it's virtually wide open. I mean, the fishermen can't catch every single fish. So even when they're fishing it ad lib, they can't get them all. But the harvest rate definitely goes up. So here we have a situation where either early migrating populations may be fished less, and so might increase in abundance, or early migrating individuals within populations would be fished less. Either one of those could provide an impetus for selection for earlier timing. And in fact, that's what we're starting to see. Now, of course, the fish are 5 or 6 years old. They've got, you know, fairly long generation time, so we're not seeing all of this click in. In one case, a highly significant change, and the other nearly significant if you're slave to 5% chance of being wrong. Consistent with the idea, though, that there is an effect of that selection on their migratory timing. So by way of conclusion, all the salmon populations, both at the level of the species and the individual population, have evolved patterns of migration timing, spawning timing that are keyed to the physical conditions that are experienced by the adults en route and on the spawning grounds, the thermal regime of the incubation grounds, and the timing when the youngsters have to emerge in the spring. These things are obviously being batted back and forth constantly because warm year, cold year, high density, low density, gravel scour, a lot of those kinds of processes have stabilized them around optimal periods. As the climate changes, they may start to move those, although it may occasionally get up against a wall where they're pushed back by something else and experience lower fitness. Hatchery practices demonstrate powerfully the genetic control over these processes by virtue of how quickly we can move the populations, and in some cases we're moving them in a direction which is inconsistent with what natural selection would have provided, as in examples here in Lake Washington. In addition, fisheries exert a powerful selective force, and there's a lot of literature recently on the evolutionary effects of fisheries on size and age at maturity. The truth is, size and age at maturity are strongly influenced by growing conditions. Most of the size of a fish is determined by the environment. In contrast, the heritability of migration and spawning data in salmon is much, much higher. So the scope for change is actually much greater. And if you think about it, virtually all fisheries have a substantial timing component. Whether it's largemouth bass, you don't start fishing until after May 15th. Either you fish at the beginning of the season, the end. Most fisheries have a timing component, and the capacity to be affecting the evolutionary trajectory of these populations, either in synergy or in opposition to the natural and climate-changing processes, is something that we should think about. I'll stop there, give you an image of some fish migrating up a river, and take any questions if I've got time. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question was, he was pointing out that there seems to be a problem here. If natural selection and artificial selection are pointing in opposite directions, the population gets squeezed. We actually see this at our University of Washington hatchery. So the first Chinook salmon that come in the door are now so early, the water is so warm, that their embryos basically all die unless we put them on a chiller. Of course, if that was in a river, they just would die because we wouldn't have a chiller in the river. So there will be, eventually, natural selection will be pushing back in the other direction. And the problem is that you may stabilize at a point which is less productive than the one that you had before. But obviously, it won't keep getting earlier and earlier and earlier. There will be something else that will push against it, either pathogens on the adult, mortality on the embryos. Okay, thanks a lot. Which one of these do you get both of these?